general public that are here too, to ask some questions as well, because it seemed like every time we had a question, we could talk to you, we got a very satisfactory answer. Where are you, by the way? Where are you located?
In Los Angeles.
Oh, you're in, well, you're not too far off our time schedule then, you're just not here. Yeah.
Right.
Okay, well, the first question, we had a representative of the small business community here the last time we had this bill last week, and they were questioning the efficiency and the reasoning for instance, going so far as saying even gift certificates, maybe a $5 gift certificate. Is that a characteristic, we know it's in a uniform bill, but is that a characteristic of the bills that most of the states have passed, and is that enforced, or is it just sort of ignored, you know, the question being, is somebody really going to have to keep track of a $3 or a $5 gift certificate for 5 years and then turn it over and that sort of thing, or is that perhaps more trouble than it's worth? Could you give us any thoughts on that, please?
Sure. Here's what the situation is. Every state that has adopted an unclaimed property law has included in it provisions that cover gift certificates. Generally, the small business would not have much property to report at all. And in fact, what the law does is it relieves these businesses of any obligations to keep records by allowing them to turn the property over. And it's because of this law, the small business would not have to retain a record. Otherwise, it would have to keep records of these outstanding gift certificates, because if anybody presents one, they need to know that they've issued it. There are situations which will develop where you may have a little bit of property, like script given to a customer or a credit memo and that kind of thing, that are not part of the regular accounting procedures. In that case, none of the states enforce the law on that property. So it would only be significant amounts that really would become subject to the law. I happen to think it's very beneficial because it allows the business person to get rid of these records. Otherwise, they'd have to keep them for a long period of time.
Okay. Another question somebody raised, and I'm not sure, I think it was at least one element of the banking community. We've got in there the bank deposit box. That property comes under the purview of the bill after 5 years. The suggestion was made that perhaps 1 year would be better because the banks, I presume, when a person's you know, died or dropped out of sight or for some reason or other not available, I presume the bank would like to drill that key out of the or that lock out of the box and get rid of the property that's in it. Would 1 year be better than five?
I think it definitely would be. It's a tremendous expense to the banks. The people wander off, don't pay the rent. The bank is charged with the expense of safekeeping these items until they can be relieved of that obligation under your unclaimed property law. And I can think of no reason why someone who's abandoned the box and is no longer paying rent on it should be able to get for nothing safekeeping services from the bank. And that's a proper role of the state, and I would heartily endorse a one-year period. And of course, the sooner you advertise the name of the missing safe deposit box owner, the more likely it is that you'll turn that person up. So I think it's distinctly in the interest of all parties that the time period be cut. And when I worked on the Uniform Law Commission, there was no thought given to any particular time period, and the banks at that time actually were recommending even a shorter time period. So that's there's no uniformity required in this area, and I encourage you to do that.
Okay, I had two questions. I'm going to ask one of the attorneys here to help me phrase the question, because I've got just short notes on it. But one of the questions had to do with bankruptcies. When a company goes bankrupt, let's see, Mr. Member, do you remember the circumstance on that? Yeah, Mr. Phillips is here too. Go ahead.
No, I don't. I'm just trying to reuse your.
Yeah, I know.
Is this the case where a person walks into a business establishment and takes it and it comes back, and they the business itself will give them a credit only. And then what happens if business goes bankrupt? Is that, are we on the right trend here, or is this a different one?
Yeah, and also we were talking about wages under the bankruptcy situation. Perhaps you could just even kind of give us a little view on the bankruptcy situation as effective.
Yes, here's how the Bankruptcy Act works. It has its own private estate law that supersedes all the state unclaimed property laws, unfortunately. And your unclaimed property law does not apply to bankruptcy situations. Let me give you a few examples. Let's assume that somebody in a bankruptcy fails to claim a payment that they're entitled to because they had originally submitted a claim that they were owed money, either as wages or payment on some obligation. If they later fail to cash that check, and it becomes unclaimed, it is subject to the Federal Bankruptcy Act, and it will not go to the state. The law is well established in that area. So anything that ends up in bankruptcy will be automatically excluded from your unclaimed property law.
Okay, well, I guess that at least makes it simple. It may or may not be good, but it's simple.
There is no procedure in the bankruptcy court to contact the missing owners, and it's rather unfortunate, but there's nothing we can do about that.
Okay. Another question that I had somebody raised is the phrasing of the Uniform Act. It was not 100% clear to us when we're talking about deposit box, the verbiage that is used could be construed to even mean like mini storages and that sort of thing, but that is not the case. Is that right? I mean, we're strictly talking, when we're talking about bank deposit boxes, we're really only talking about bank deposit boxes. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's my understanding. It's the only non-cash items that are subject to the Uniform Unclaimed Property Act that you're reviewing are items held in a safe deposit box. Other than that, there's no intention to pick up other types of tangible property that might be held in storage. Some of the states have been burdened with guns that have gone unclaimed and fur coats and bicycles and things like that. Normally, a state has other laws to handle that situation. And I would suspect that's the case with Alaska.
Mr. Grunberg had a question.
Yeah, Mr. Epstein, Max Grunberg here. With respect to the chairman's last question, what we were considering is an amendment to section 260. Do you happen to have a copy of that section? That's the section we were just chatting about.
Okay,
right,
let me pull that out.
Contents of safe deposit box or other safekeeping repository.
What page does that appear on the bill?
Well, it appears in our bill on approximately page 17.
Okay.
I thought the other speaker was an older guy, professor.
Remember? I've located it.
It would say all tangible and intangible personal property held in a safe deposit box or other safekeeping repository, and then adding this phrase, in a financial institution in the state. What do you think about that? Would that do it?
That's fine.
Thank you.
Mr. Grunberg might be able to refresh, or Mr. Taylor might be able to refresh my memory too. We were concerned about the attorney-client privilege. Max, do you recall what our problem was on the attorney-client privilege, the privacy during investigations, that sort of thing? What was the question area there?
Trust accounts.
Yeah, and trust accounts. Yeah. Is there any problem or anything we should? You thinking about in that area?
I'm trying to envision how a problem would arise. Could you give me an example?
Got a question? Mr. Epstein, maybe I can. The attorney, the client comes to the attorney, leaves $10,000 with him, and says, hold this for Joe Blow. He will arrive 15 years from now on the good ship Lollipop.
This is Max Grimmer again. I can give you another example. Situation where I'm a family lawyer myself, and this could happen. A husband comes in and says, I want to retain you. I don't want to file against Daisy Mae right now. And he comes in every now and then and has a consultation, and you take a little money out of the trust account. But Daisy May is not to know. And so a few years goes by, something occurs, and then winds up with a name in the paper or notice going to the home, and Daisy May opens it and says, "What were you going down to Max, your friendly divorce lawyer, for?"
And I think what would happen in this situation is that the attorney would be required, just as a fiduciary, to undertake an independent effort to locate the person. And if they could, they would return the money directly to the person. Now, let's assume that in the course of the investigation, you discover the person is dead. Well, then I suppose that money would be administered in their estate, and that the attorney would make arrangements to pay it over to the estate. Let's assume you can't find the person any longer. And then we have truly an unclaimed property situation. I would think in that instance that there would be a way to report that to the state without making any embarrassing disclosure. But otherwise what would happen is that the person would never get their money back.
Yeah, it's probably too remote a hypothetical, actually. I'm not too worried about it. Thank you.
Okay, I can assure you that on the experience I've had, we've never had a situation yet where somebody came forward and said, "Oh my God, I was embarrassed by the disclosure." In every instance, they've always been delighted to get their money back, and they can figure out an explanation after the fact.
Thank you, David.
Okay.
What's been the procedure when two people have a claim on the same piece of property? The father's name appears in the paper, he's deceased, and two brothers claim something like that. How does the state know who gets the who gets the piece of property?
Here's how it works. Under the claim payment section that's in the law, the state then undertakes to determine who's entitled to it. And this situation will happen all the time, and this provides a very valuable service to the original holders of the property, because they're in no position at all to resolve some of these issues, and the state can do it with some certainty. So if the person, what the claim payment officer will do is they will say, was there a will? And if there was, they will then look at the terms of the will. If the person died without a will, in that case, they will apply what the state laws for intestacy would determine as to who could claim. If there still remains some ambiguity as to who's entitled to the property, the states are very pragmatic. If you're talking about a few hundred dollars and it would cost somebody thousands of dollars to hire an attorney to resolve the thing, what the states generally do is they pay the person, but they get an agreement from that person indemnifying the state should somebody else come forward and make a claim. There have been a handful of instances where there was really substantial amounts of property involved. In that case, what the state did is they told the claimants that you better hire an attorney and have your attorneys come in and make a presentation. And if we can handle it, we will. Otherwise, we'll just have to pay the money over to the court and let the court decide who receives it. But that's a real unusual situation.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. Mr. Greenberg.
Mr. Epstein, this is something we've talked about before, and it has to do with the dormancy charges on bank accounts. And in our draft, we're talking about the bottom of page 9, top of page 10, where it has the language, and I know we've discussed this before, a charge due to dormancy or inactivity may not be charged unless there's the written contract and for property in excess of $10, there's a written notice, et cetera, no more than 3 months before the imposition of the charges, and that the holder regularly imposes the charges or ceases payment of interest. Are you with me?
Yes.
Okay. We have talked, several of us have talked about several possible amendments to that because of the possibility of abuse here. And one possibility would be to strike everything in subsection B after the word interest on line 2. So it would read that A holder may not impose with respect to property described in subsection A a charge due to dormancy or inactivity or cease payment of interest, period. That's one alternative. Another alternative would be to strike the language, and this is in subsection 1, on lines 5 and 6, and insert the following. So subsection 1 would read as follows. Unless there is an enforceable written contract between the holder and the owner of the property under which the holder may impose a specific charge or cease payment of interest, the conditions under which the charge will be imposed are stated in the contract, the charge is reasonable, and the charge is reasonable. In order to be valid and enforceable, the contract must be written in clear and easily understandable language, and if the contract is contained within a larger written agreement, the contract must be set out in bold print in the agreement and separately initialed by the owner. So number one would prohibit it entirely. Number two would make sure it's really legible. What do you think?
Well, there's a couple of issues here. The before the deregulation of banking, the concept by which people paid for their checking and savings accounts was such that there was basically no understanding by the consumer that they might incur charges for banking services, other than, particularly in the case of savings accounts. I mean, the assumption was that I have a savings account and all I have to do is leave my money there. I don't have to touch the interest. And I'll get all of that money back plus the interest compounded. I think that that has changed substantially in the last few years because everybody has now seen that there's a variety of savings instruments with varying time periods and varying conditions under which they can deposit money and withdraw it. And savings accounts can, in fact, be checking accounts at the same time. And I think the consumers at this point are a lot more aware that there are these charges that may be incurred for a variety of reasons. And that wasn't true 4 or 5 years ago. So the issue now becomes how far you want to go in establishing state policy as to what the terms of those agreements might be. I think that you're certainly entitled to do that as to state banks. And the only time the issue has been litigated recently in connection with the national bank, the California Supreme Court basically said that state contract laws are not preempted by the National Banking Act, and that therefore the state can come in and establish the terms of certain of those contracts. So with that as a background, you really get a policy issue here. Many depositors are unaware that merely by leaving their money inactive, it may become subject to a charge. And one of the provisions you read was really designed to get at perhaps a more complete disclosure of that fact than is presently made. Most people, when they open an account, are provided with some rather detailed terms of exactly how it's going to operate. But when they get to the section that refers to what additional charges you may incur because the account is inactive, most people don't pay attention to that because the reason they're opening the account was to keep it active, and they're not thinking about it 5 or 10 years from now. I'm not giving you anything specific here because I think it's really a policy judgment that has to be made by the legislature, and obviously you people are in the best position to do that. I am not completely familiar with what the service charge practice is in Alaska. It varies considerably from state to state. In some states, it's very benign and may not even need any further regulation. In other states, I've seen charges that have gone as high as $400 or $500 against an inactive savings account, merely because the property was sitting there inactive. In that case, some type of legislative regulation might be required.
The practice, I am informed by my staff here, who has checked with a couple of banks, is that one bank here, two banks in Alaska have a history of charging significant dormancy charges, $3 per month and $25 per year. But most banks in Alaska don't charge it at all. The two apparently do.
Which two?
The two that do are the First National Bank of Alaska and the was formerly the Anchorage Bank of Commerce. The Alaska Bank of Commerce is now First Interstate Bank.
Gotta get my money out.
Only if you're gonna go dormant for about 20 years.
My personal feeling is that in deregulated banking, whatever the bank and the customer agree to, that's okay with me. I think that the customers, under that circumstance, if a full disclosure is made and a meaningful disclosure, that I'm not sure what further steps ought to be taken in regulating that activity. Some of the problems that have arisen in other states, and I'm not sure they're present in Alaska, because as I indicated when I testified previously, the reports that were being filed appear to be very substantial by the banks and quite complete. The situation that you've indicated, there would be all kinds of questions that arise, in which even in the absence of this legislation, they may not be able to take those charges. Most of the cases have held that you have to have a contract that provides for the charges. And if those charges are recently adopted and they are not communicated to a missing owner, which usually you cannot do because you can't find the owner to tell them the new terms, then I think under most existing laws, there simply wouldn't be a contract to take the payment. And even if you didn't pass this legislation, that deduction would not be allowed in the absence of a valid contract. What the Uniform Law Commission intended to do basically to restate what they thought was the existing law of contracts as it applied to savings and checking accounts.
Yeah, the thing I'm concerned about is I'm sure that these cases, particularly involving small depositors, people who are not very sophisticated, will not be litigated. And I want to stop this and not require the people to have to go to court, because that just won't happen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh. The state gets involved at the point the account becomes abandoned, and the state says, have you made any deductions from those accounts? And the bank makes a disclosure, yes, we took service charges, and then generally what a state says is, do you have a contract that provides for the service charges? The frequent practice until recently is if the person reappeared before the account was reported to the state, that the bank would not deduct the charge. They would waive it. And the law as it's now written, the one you're reviewing, would take care of that situation. They'd say, well, look, if that's your practice to waive the charge, then it should be waived as to the state so we can return the entire account to the owner. I've seen very few instances where the owner reappeared and says, well, wait, I was unaware of that charge, and the banking institution insists that it's going to deduct the charge. But this really is a matter for the legislature to determine whether they want to regulate that activity in terms of the disclosure that's required. There is one state, Oregon, that has in its regulations a rather elaborate requirement with regard to disclosure of service charges. And their regulations go so far as to provide the size of the print type by which the disclosure of the service charge must be made. In this case here, if the person is still available, they'll get notice of the charge because they have to send out a notice to the banking institution. And if the person persists in not reading their mail or insisting on leaving the account there, in that case, the bank would appear to be entitled to the charge. It's difficult to give you a definitive answer for this reason. Before deregulated banking, the charge really appeared to be unfair. I can't say that now, given what the mix is and what charges are going to be imposed and what level of accounts, I'm not sure that this charge now becomes as unfair as it used to be. It becomes part of the whole pattern by which the banks recapture their cost of handling the accounts. And so it's a real mixed bag, as far as I can tell.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
The suggestion was made by at least one member of the committee earlier that we not allow the department to, on a you know, a random sample, investigate you know, private businesses. They felt these were just, at least that one member felt that these were just fishing expeditions and not a legitimate function of government. If we adopted an amendment saying that in the absence of some evidence that the that a business or a group that's supposed to report under this was not doing so, the state could not come in and conduct an investigation. What's your thoughts on that?
The Old Unclaimed Property Act, the 1954 Unclaimed Property Act, had a provision in there that the state could look at the holder's records if it had reason to believe that they were holding abandoned property. That requirement was eliminated from the 1981 Act. The reason for that is there had been a handful of situations in which the holder of the property was saying, unless you can identify the specific property that's become abandoned, you cannot look at our records. And of course, the state was in no position to be able to do that. They had plenty of reason to believe that the institution was holding abandoned property because it never filed a report. And they know from all the other institutions of similar size and age that they had regularly reported abandoned property. So the drafting committee for the Uniform Law Commission said, well, let's eliminate this reason to believe requirement. However, I think in the absence of that requirement, there is more than adequate authority, and it has been confirmed in a Minnesota case a few years ago, that if a holder wants to object to having its records reviewed, under these notions of administrative search and seizure, and there's a whole series of U.S. Supreme Court cases on the subject, the state must in fact establish reason to believe. And this section, the way it's now written, if any institution objected to a state examiner coming in and looking at the records, what would then transpire is the state would have to go to court. And in that proceeding, the state, in fact, would have to establish it had reason to believe. If you were to add in that language to the act as it now exists, I don't think there'd be any problem at all. I think it would just be a restatement of what the existing law is in any event. And if it would make people more comfortable, I would encourage you to do that.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Taylor, did you have a question you wanted to ask, or do you want to hold off for a minute? Yeah, I had one other. And Mr. Jenkins, if you join us at the table, Mr. Jenkins is here from the an organization representing small businesses throughout Alaska, and he had a number of concerns. Perhaps you could sort of give us the give Mr. Epstein the Reader's Digest condensation of your concerns and let him respond to them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Gary Jenkins for the record. Our concerns mainly dealt with, again, the impact on small business of the reporting requirements for gift certificates, credit memos, and there's a couple other things. Let's see, the definition of intangible property talks about customer overpayments, credit balances, a whole host of things that in the typical small business, and again, my orientation is toward the small business, the mom and pop, which we have a tremendous number around the state of Alaska. The way that the proposed law here is drafted, technically, is if you have a small amount as $1, you're supposed to account for it, turn it over, and this type of thing. And it just is seems to be, to me, to be a very significant burden as far as the record-keeping requirements on the businesses. I know in your first comment on gift certificates, the question that Representative Miller raised was they could turn over right away, but you have a situation where you can't really turn over right away because people may show up a year, year and a half later with their gift certificate in hand and say, hey, you know, here's my gift certificate somebody bought for me, I want to claim it. So it's not a situation, doesn't seem to me, that, you know, after just a few months you would turn it over. So there is a significant record-keeping requirement. My suggestion to the committee was to put at least some type of a de minimis rule in here of an amount of, say, $500 or something of that nature, that if it was above that, then it'd have to be accounted for.
That's what I was trying to refer to.
I have seen in one state a provision that says that if during any period the amount of abandoned property that's held is less than, I think it was $100 or $250, a no report would be required. I don't think there's any intention here to impose any new record-keeping obligations on small businesses. I know from my own personal knowledge that there are no small businesses reporting abandoned property anywhere in the United States. And I know that there isn't a single state that has ever audited or attempted to enforce its law against somebody who might have $5 or $10 or even $100 worth of abandoned property. And the thrust of this law is really not to get at the sporadic situation where you might have a grocery store or some real small retail store that has just a teeny bit of property. And if you wanted to put into your law some exclusion for running along the amounts that you had described, I don't know why that would be a problem. I do know that no state has the resources or the interest to go and pursue that kind of situation. And I think they all have the common sense to avoid the problem that you're concerned with.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that comment, and I've talked to other states, and I think that's generally what's happening. I guess our concern is I hate to see it written into law, and then with the kind of concept as well, we'll write it, but we'll ignore it. I would prefer that it be an exception be put into law.
Mr. Gunberg has something on that same subject.
Yes. I am reluctant to go wholesale drafting into this thing. What Mr. Jenkins said is very persuasive to me. And Mr. Epstein, I would be grateful if my staff could contact you and we could come up with some language that would meet the problems of Mr. Jenkins in a manner that's entirely compatible with the Act. Could my staff give you a call a little later
Absolutely. I think we can come up with a one-sentence provision that would handle it.
Thank you. We will do that later this morning. Mark will call you. Thank you.
Get the number?
Thank you very much on that, and thank you. I had one other question I wanted to ask. Later on this morning, we'll be hearing from at least one person representing a highway association, a co-op, and people from this type of business have been in my office a couple of times. Their concern is that the by having to return deposits that have been abandoned, in some cases for 10, 15, 20 years, particularly in a cooperative situation where there, at least theoretically, there's no profits, what that means is everybody else's rates have to go up. Do you have any knowledge of exceptions to cooperative utilities or anybody else, or in the other states, have they just been treated like any other utility?
No. The co-ops have been very actively accepting themselves out of unclaimed property laws in many, many states. The situation is as follows. I think the threshold question is what do they do now when somebody who is entitled to a distribution from a co-op, which has been declared presumably set aside on their books, do they pay this person if they appear later on? And does that materially interfere with the operation of the co-op? These may well be contract claims, and if they are, the state probably can't reach them going back more than 6 years because the statute of limitations would have run on those claims. So to the extent that they're subject to the statute of limitations, any concerns about these old monies are probably not well-founded because I don't think they would be subject to this new act. I don't think you can go back and get items that are time-barred. If they're not subject to a statute of limitations, then they're raising a concern, which would turn on how they accounted for it on their books. If at the time they declared this payment, they set aside the money by showing that it was, in fact, an obligation of the co-op, I'm not sure how it could be used for the benefit of the existing members, because their books all along would have reflected that this was one of their obligations. There's been some notion among the co-ops that the money should be put to some other use. There are several states where the co-ops have had legislation passed that provide it can go to charities designated by the co-op. In a few cases, they provided for the money to be redistributed to people who are presently locatable. The policy issue, as I see it, is whether some effort should be made to look for the missing owners of the distributions from the co-ops, because that is not a widespread practice in many states, although I have absolutely no information with regard to what's happening in Alaska. If you had this law in the book, what it would really do is it would encourage the co-op, when it made a payment, to see if they could locate the missing owner. But I want to say something in all fairness. In many cases, years and years go by before they're financially able to declare some type of a distribution. And by that time, a lot of the people who had originally participated in the co-op are no longer there. And they literally can't be found. I think this is a question addressed to the sound discretion of the legislature and how you want to handle it. There is more than adequate precedent for those types of exceptions.
Okay, thank you very much. Do we have any other questions for members of the committee? Okay, well, once again, we're just very very appreciative of your taking the time to advise us in this area.
Anybody in the audience?
Yeah, Mr. Phillips makes a good suggestion, since we're pretty informal here today. Does anybody in the audience have any questions they'd like to ask? Okay, well, I think your answers have been very complete. We thank you very much, David. And
okay.
Have a pleasant day. We'll be back in touch with you, letting you know how this goes. Mr. Grunberg, get it.
Yeah, we'll be calling you later this morning on the one amendment.
Fine, I'll be here. And good luck on your new law.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate your help. And we'll sign off the teleconference now. Thank you again.
Bye-bye.
Like other co-ops, like co-ops, like with MEA, when they first started back in the 40s, and then they have what's called a capital improvement dividend, whatever they call it. And this is it reaches well, like the 20th year, and then they start giving it out. And I've noticed they put publications in the paper, sent out like 35 letters, trying to locate it. But I don't believe we should go with 6 or 7 year limitation, because the dividends don't really come until after 20 years, by and large.
Yeah, we'll have some testimony in a few minutes.
I know.
Alexander Hope from Glacier Highway Electrical Association wants to talk.
But you said roads.
I misspoke myself. I don't even know what a road co-op is.
Well, road. We have road associations.
Did I say road? Yeah, it's the Glacier Highway Electric Association.
Mr. Chairman,
my company. Yeah, Mr. Grunberg.
We're going to take some more testimony. Can we? Will we be able to start marking up today?
Well, I think we've got a technical problem. I've got a small crisis. I was going to turn the meeting over to you. I think we'll take the testimony, and then what I think we'll do, I think you and I will reinvest ourselves as the subcommittee and do a markup and try to get suggestions from everybody. I think we've probably got everybody's suggestions,
right.
And then we'll come back simply with a bill that for people to look at.
We can take a few minutes tomorrow.
Yeah, very possibly, yeah.
Okay.
But in just a couple of minutes, I'm going to have to turn the gavel to you. We're going to be in tomorrow, of course.
Okay. Let me keep this with me.
Did you want to talk to
me? Well, at this time, I see it.
So if you get me those amendments, we'll be able to do it.
Okay. Alexander, do you want to join us? And if I walk out right in the middle of your presentation, it won't be for lack of interest. It's just that I've got a small price.
Chairman Miller, members of the committee. My name is Alexander Hoke. I represent the Glacier Highway Electric Association. This deals with the utility question was just raised. Basically, we're looking for an exemption under HB 182. Our cooperative serves 1,400 members in the northern sector of the city and borough of Juneau. We borrow funds from two agencies, the Rural Electrification Administration and the CFC. Our lenders require us to operate with a specific margin, and which would otherwise be a profit for an investor-owned utility. Our bylaws provide that we return those margins to our member consumers as we are able in terms of having financial surpluses through the years.
What's that called?
We call them capital credits.
Okay, that's the same thing.
Now, we've been in existence since 1946. We're essentially 40 years old now. This is the first year that we've had financial wherewithal to consider retiring some of our capital credits. The concern that we have is that we're in our first cut on this thing. We're talking about $78,000 trying to retire capital credits from its inception of the organization through about 1965. We anticipate that roughly half of that money will be unclaimed. Our hope was to recycle that money into the next year, 1966, and retire capital credits for members through 1966. Obviously, it's very painful for us to reach a position where we can consider retiring any of our capital credits. So it's an important concern for us, in spite of the fact that it's only roughly $40,000 that we're talking about in this first cut.
This 20-year cycle.
Well, what we want to try to do is get to the point eventually that we've got a 10-year cycle. Right now, we're working on a 20-year cycle.
Yeah, we're the same way. We're not 20 years.
Yeah. So it's taken us a lot of years to get to the point where we can consider the first cut. Basically, our position is that, like other nonprofit organizations, it's difficult for us to raise funds in the first place. I mean, it's painful for our members. If I'm not mistaken, our consumers pay more for electric power than anyone else in the state. We don't fall under the power cost equalization subsidy, and we have additional. We have the higher costs of a rural co-op.
8 cents per watt?
Well, it's more like 14, 15 cents.
Okay.
So we consider this to be a serious problem in draining resources that are important for us for our goals, which are essentially to return those margins to our member consumers. We have essentially two arguments. One is that the money is difficult for us to raise in the first place, like other nonprofit cooperatives, and we feel that it defeats our purposes to have the money returned to the broad spectrum of Alaskans society, as opposed to the specific goals that our members organized under. And the second argument is that, we feel that this money is, you know, serves the purpose of a specific group of people, that they essentially entered the co-op with an implicit contract and a sort. They make an investment through their bills each month, not only to pay the current cost of providing them the service, but also for the long-term financial viability of the organization. And we feel that there's almost an implicit contract between our members and the organization that their contributions would serve the overall long-term purposes of the organization. So I guess we consider the provisions of HB 182 to be kind of an invasion of our resource pool and our ability to maintain that long-term financial vitality. It's definitely a judgment call, but it's a significant issue to us.
Just give me your amendment, whatever
you want. I'm glad to answer any questions.
I'm sympathetic.
It's suggested language.
Oh, is it?
Let me ask you this question. The other side. If you weren't a co-op, if you were a ELMP, people only join, sign up to co-op just because they happen to live right there. I mean, it's not like a fraternal organization that you join because you like camaraderie and monthly meetings or something like that. For the user, it's just simply a utility. And yet, if the person makes a deposit at ALMP, they obviously come under the purview of this legislation, and should. And yet, they're doing the same thing. They're both in the business of providing electricity to a customer who didn't really choose to join the co-op. They had to if they wanted electricity. Mm-hmm. So, I keep having a hard time understanding why. I happen to be paying both. I've got a property out the road, so I'm a member of the co-op, and in town I pay my bill to A, L, and B. In both cases, I'm just buying electricity. And as I say, it's not like it was a fraternal organization that I chose to put my money into because I was just all caught up in the thrill of the organization.
I see it as a, I live in a cooperative, it's called MEA, and you have a lot more control as a cooperative member than if you're just paying a bill to some utility. I mean, we elect our board of directors, these guys live right next door, if you got a problem, go talk to them. I'll speak in favor of the concept of them. I think they're more responsive to the needs of the consumer than, say, some profit-making utility. I don't know. I think we got a pretty good cooperative, and anything we can do to help them out.
Mr. Chairman, I think you raise a good point. It's a difficult one to analyze. Initially, when our co-op was organized, it was very much a fraternal organization. Mm-hmm. Basically, the existing private utility that was serving the communities of Juneau and Douglas considered it unprofitable to extend a line out to Auk Bay. Mm-hmm. So basically, we had a group of residents that got together, pooled their resources, and started a cooperative. The whole notion of the bylaws that provide for return of these margins is almost a gratuity in a sense. I mean, you don't put money into the system expecting to get a return on your investment. You're going to be lucky if you get your investment back ever. I mean, now it's already been 40 years. It is a close call on that. And one consideration is, though, that the money that we cannot recycle back into that would come under the unclaimed property provisions of HB 182, that we can't recycle back into our capital credits retirement program, would essentially require us to place an additional burden on our existing members to make up that loss, because we do have that obligation to former members, and we're going to have to meet it one way or another, and essentially we have to raise our rates to make up the difference. That's basically what it comes down to.
I'm going to go upstairs in just a second. I'll get together with Mr. Renberg, if you remember the subcommittee. But I just want to raise one quick question, because how do you differentiate between the glacier highways of this world and smaller and Chugach, which I understand is the world's largest, or at least the United States' world's largest cooperative? It probably is, as a matter of fact, but at least in the United States. And in no sense is it this call up your neighbor's camaraderie type thing. I mean, it is big business in every sense and definition of the world, and if we give exception to...
Well, Mr. Chairman, we have, in MEA, we're the second largest. We have 60,000. And we,
this is a homespun organization?
It is. 60,000? It started out in essentially what Hope is saying right here.
It started out that way, but right now.
Right, and we still have access to our people. I mean, in fact, we throw people out of the,
I heard about that.
You know what I'm talking about? I mean, we have 1,000 people usually show up every April or May for our annual meeting.
I've got to apologize. I'm well familiar with the problem, so I don't feel too bad about leaving.
And one thing I want to add is that you don't expect the money to come back. A lot of these people are getting the money back or surprised they haven't checked.
I'm concerned about the fact that the amendment would apply to all co-ops. Is your co-op a 501c3 organization. Is it tax exempt? It is tax exempt.
Yes.
Okay. The just the size, we've got co-ops that run from tiny little co-ops to the largest in the country. And there's very little in Anchorage. There's very little difference from a policy point of view in Anchorage between the municipal power and light, which will have utility deposits that will have to give the money to the state on the one hand, and Chugach. They both serve approximately, I think, around half of the city, and maybe more or less. But it just happens that if you live on one side of the street, you're served by Chugach. If you live across the street, you're served by MLNP. And it's a contract of adhesion in either sense of the word for the homeowner. You get no choice.
If you don't live on the street, you're served by MEA.
And if you don't, yeah. So it's just a strict, fortuitous situation. It may have started out as a little co-op. And they certainly do have very much of an interest among their members in coming to the meetings. On the other hand, the MLNP is run basically through the municipal assembly in Anchorage. And so, their similarities may be greater than their differences. And why should we exempt one from the act and not the other, looking at the real way things operate?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I would say that from my point of view, it would be very difficult to differentiate between the two. We're both nonprofit cooperatives in terms of our bylaws, the way we operate, the way we function. Essentially what happens is, because of our financial requirements from our lenders, ratepayers, that is people who pay their electric bills under a cooperative, essentially pay more than is necessary to break even in order to meet that financial requirement. They're paying, essentially the cooperative concept is you pay just enough on your electric bill to break even. But in the real world, because our bondholders require this profit and this margin, which would otherwise be a profit, we wind up with this problem of capital credit. I guess it's just a question of what public purpose is being served. On the one hand, if the money reverts to the state, it's going to serve the benefit of all residents of Alaska. On the other hand, the ratepayers are saying, hey, wait a minute, we're paying enough for our electric bills right now. Okay, why not have that same money returned to benefit the current ratepayers? Because they're the ones charged with the burden under our bylaws of raising enough revenue to pay off the former capital credits. So in other words, it's kind of like keeping the whole thing in-house.
Let me then play the devil's advocate. If you have, let's take you out of Juniper and have you living in Anchorage, served by MLNP. The rates and everything could be structured in a manner there so that the utility deposits would be plowed back and therefore make a difference in the rates that are subsequently paid by subscribers. How would you answer the question why they should have their utility deposits as cheap to the state and Chugach not?
I think it's, Mr. Chairman, I think it's essentially gets back to the concept of cooperative. The cooperative is a group of people organized to benefit each other. It's just, it's a very close judgment call, and I guess that's what it comes
down
to.
I just wonder if there was anything else. Yes, Mr. Phillips.
Are you talking just about the utility deposit before
that's
you hook up? Or are we talking about the dividend?
We're talking about
dividend.
Something like a dividend, yes.
Yeah, we're talking about something different than that. Not the deposit.
You're not talking about
we're
the
talking
utility
about the capital
deposits.
Dividend.
Do you have a problem with the utility deposits going?
I guess from our point of view, it's the same argument from our perspective applies. But
I'm only making
the main discussion we have today is with the capital credits, because that is a significant dollar figure for us.
I see, and then your argument would be that for a municipal utility, there is no such thing as a distribution.
There is no equivalent to it.
Right.
I see, okay.
Usually subsidized by the through property tax.
I see. Any other questions, Mr. Holmes? Anything else you'd like to
add?
Thank
you very much.
Yes, sir, please come up and identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I didn't get a chance to sign in on the sheet to testify. I came in a few minutes late. But I do want to address this exact same
amendment. Of course.
My name is, for the record, Ken Johnson, and I'm representing the Alaska Rural Electric Cooperative Association. And basically, the amendment that we've given you today is just a reiteration of existing law in the general nonprofit cooperative statute. Under 1015-295, this is basically the exact same language. In other words, all cooperatives except utilities at this particular point do not have to forfeit unclaimed property back to the state. So, and there's some question, I guess our attorneys feel that there's some legal question as to whether or not that should apply to the utilities. And basically this would just reiterate again what's already in law for the nonprofit cooperatives. Basically, we're more concerned about the capital credits than we are about consumer deposits. I would estimate that somewhere in the vicinity of $300,000 to $400,000 of the cooperatives collective cooperative capital credits offered this year will not be claimed. That money is margins with which, if they revert back into the cooperative, will mean less money that the current members would actually have to bear in creating those margins in the coming year. So basically, we're just, and as far as as MLMP goes, they don't, you know, in building their equity, they don't offer the consumers who signed up 20 years ago a refund.
So I understand. Yes. Representative Clark?
I wanted to complete his thought, but I want to ask a question.
Certainly. Please.
Well, that's basically all I have to say.
In that case, could you identify for me the portion of the bill that does require the lapsing or the cheating of capital credits, and the portion of the bill that applies, that makes it applicable to cooperative utilities and not other cooperatives?
Well, what I'm saying is that this bill, and under this bill, cooperatives would be included in.
I think I can.
I'm sorry.
I think I can identify what he's talking about. The question was, where in the bill does it say that capital contributions must be returned to the state? And I think the answer to that is Section 120. It's a general rule for taking custody of unclaimed intangible property. It's page 3. This would just come under the general unclaimed property. There's no specific.
Oh, I've got, what draft are you looking
for? I was looking. It's all the same. But it may be a page a little different.
Page 4.
Page 4?
Yes, of the 4-2 draft, it's the general rule, page 4, starting on line 25.
I'm sorry, yes.
And where is the rule, then, that, where is the part of this bill that says that this applies to cooperative utilities and no other cooperatives?
Well, it doesn't. What I'm saying is that in general non-profit cooperative statutes is a section, 1015-295, which is basically is the same language that is offered in this amendment. It is just not in 1025, which is the cooperative utilities statutes. So this would, again, go into 1025 as well as 1015. The only difference is basically the time, the elapsed time here was change to parallel what is in this particular bill as far as the time frames with which the money from other unclaimed properties would escape to the state, rather they would, you know, go back into the co-op during those same
times.
If I can just follow
sure,
up.
Of course.
You made the assertion that there were constitutional or legal problems with this. Those legal problems exist in the current law on co-ops then, right?
Well...
Because there is a difference between the general cooperative law and the law on cooperative utilities.
Yes.
But isn't this bill the...
No. I didn't mean to give you that the idea that we were saying this bill was causing it.
Thank you. Did that... Okay. Tim, what is the difference between... And I don't have my Title 10 here. What is 1015 versus 1025? Is 1025 just electrical co-ops?
Yes. Cooperative utility.
Okay, and 1015 is other...
General nonprofit co-ops.
I see. Any other questions for Mr. Johnson? Anything else you'd like to ask?
No.
Thank you very much. Anyone else who would like to testify this morning? Please, come right up.
What's the plan here?
We will go until 9:30.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Did you sign? Have a chance to sign?
Yeah, I did sign in. I'm Dick Monkman, the Deputy Commissioner for Taxation for the Department of Revenue. I just wanted to very briefly remind the committee of the old French saying that large rivers come from small streams. This bill provides a small stream of revenue to the state at a very low cost. It provides a benefit to the citizens of the state in that their unclaimed property will be advertised, attempts will be made to locate them. It also provides benefit to the citizens of the state in that we'll get quite a bit of money that presently is going into the hands of banks, insurance companies, and other jurisdictions. We have had great success over the last few years in pulling in quite a bit of money at very low cost under our present statute, which is antiquated, which is less inclusive than this bill. We respectfully request that, or hope that you will approve of this bill and in the very near future so that it can go its way through the legislature and become law. That's all I had to say.
Questions for Mr. Muffin?
Just on the capital credits question. I heard the testimony to say that $300,000 to $400,000 of credits would not be claimed this year, and therefore would under this legislation presumably go to the state. Is it accurate then to say that adopting this amendment would reduce the revenue to the state from this bill of about $300,000 to $400,000?
Yes, I believe that's accurate. But it should be remembered that the main impact of this bill is going to be on banks, insurance companies, corporations. That's where the bulk of the income to the state is going to come from.
What is happening to the... Well, that's not a question. Never mind. Well, I'm confused about the difference between the general co-op statute and the co-op utility statute. The cooperative statute we've had pointed out to us does allow the cooperative to take this money. If it's unclaimed, it would be logical to assume that if there is no such statute in the cooperative utility section, that they're not allowed to take the unclaimed property. What is the practice?
The present practice, I don't believe any of this money gets to the state, any cooperative money at all. We have been dealing with banks almost exclusively under the present statute.
The utility co-ops, we would assume then, have been taking these unclaimed capital credits despite the absence of a statute authorizing them to do so.
Right, because the present statute, the way the present statute works, about the only institutions we've been able to get unclaimed property from within banks, credit unions and banks. And we've had a very good working relationship with the banks and the credit unions in that regard.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr.
Trustee?
At some point I may want to challenge you on a question about the appeal procedure when the
committee
should apply, but I don't want to take the committee's time to do that.
We don't have
anything, else you'd like to
hear? Nothing else?
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who'd like to get to
Mr. Green? A couple of years ago.
Yeah. By the way, for the record, I think that it should be very clear that the committee is entirely, I think everybody I talk to agrees that this is a good bill, basically, and we support the beneficial purposes.
Not exactly Yukon River, but...
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's probably a good time to follow up on what Mr. Monkman pointed out, is that the banks and credit unions for years under the present statute have been turning money over to the state. I have suggested to the committee an amendment which leaves the time period at which time this property would become reportable, that is, demand deposits, at its present 7-year period. there are various, there's not within the bill now, a 7-year period as it applies, I believe, to the money orders. And by keeping it at 7 years, it's the position of the credit unions, and I'm here on behalf of the Alaska Credit Union League, which represents some 370,000 members throughout the state, throughout the number of credit unions, which range in size from $1 billion in assets down to about 250,000. So there's some small businesses involved there. It's their feeling that keeping it on the same time cycle as presently required by the law would be easier to administer and avoids the problem that was raised by Sharon Ellis, who testified at an earlier committee hearing, that between 5 and 7 years, she had the experience, or with her credit union, that members would come in despite long periods of inactivity and make some contact or have some activity with their account. If anything, this, by keeping it at the same time period, it would probably increase or at least not affect the revenue stream. So it isn't going to affect the fiscal note or amount of revenue that's raised, but it does give the credit union an additional period to contact the member and not be put in the position of saying to a member, we had your money, but contact Juno. Your friendly revenue agent will fix it for you. Their reaction is going to be, baloney, you fix it for me. And they're going to say, well, we don't have any obligation of the law. Now, that may be true, but that doesn't give them a very good business image. So I think they'd be happy with this and more supportive of the bill.
Is that complete?
Yeah.
He has given an amendment.
I make one comment. It was the actual page and line number were referenced to the Bannister version of March 21st. However, I think there have been about two or three.
Right. We are going, just for the record, we are going to have a subcommittee markup on this tomorrow at 9, between 9 and 10 in the morning. And I would ask anybody who has any amendments to present them to Mark here, and we will deal with them tomorrow, or they can be there tomorrow. But we will take any amendments and deal with any amendments. And if you would make certain that the pagination is correct on Mark's copy with the 4-2
okay,
version.
Got it.
Representative Clocks.
I have two questions. First, I have not been to all the meetings on this legislation. If we had adopted the amendment, would we skew or create inequities among the other requirements? As I understand, the general requirement is 5 years, it's 15 years for traveler's checks, it's 5 years for checks and drafts, and you're proposing 7. Are we creating an anomaly here by putting 1 at 7 and everything else at 5?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe so. There's a series for every kind of property, including money orders, for example, which are 7 years, and making deposits 7s isn't going to make it any more inconsistent. It's true that the general rule is 5 years, but there are a number of exceptions, and one more exception I don't think would skew the bill up. We should add the Department of Revenue has no objection to this amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to ask Mr. Monkman to confirm that and to also tell me what the fiscal impact of the amendment is.
But before that's done, Mr. Monkman, would you like to just come up and join us?
Sure.
And just stick around, because somebody may have another question for you, too.
Thank you,
Justice.
Technically,
you're one
left.
Yeah.
I'm bigger than
you. Mr. Monkman, Representative Clarkson.
I want to confirm that you have no objection to the amendment?
No, we have no objection.
What is the fiscal impact of the amendment on possible revenues to the state?
Over the long term, it probably will not be significant one way or the other.
What would it be in the sixth year?
In the sixth year? Well, obviously you would have a greater amount of money coming in the sixth and seventh year, but you would probably have a greater amount going out in claims to the department. The people who are the named account holder on those accounts are going to be able to claim the money either from the credit union or from the department in the sixth
right.
and seventh year.
Right.
So you're basically leaving the money to be managed by the credit union or the bank for those 2 years. I don't think it makes any difference one way or the other. If those people are around and they know that this account exists and they want to make a claim for it, they'll either make it to the credit union or make it to the state.
So you don't think the amendment has a substantial fiscal impact because they'll just claim it from you anyway?
Exactly.
All
You may have, you know, I guess the only fiscal impact I can see, or the only practical impact, would be the advertising of the account names in the fifth year would probably bring in some greater amount of claimants, but I don't know how much. I don't think it's going to be significant.
Any other questions for either Mr. Greening or Mr. Monk? Thank you, gentlemen, both. Anyone else who wishes to testify? Any other comments or questions from the committee? If not, it's now 9:30. The committee is adjourned. Subcommittee will meet tomorrow here from 1 to 9.
Tomorrow?
Thank you.
We're meeting tomorrow?
Well, the subcommittee.
Oh.